Well, thank you all for coming here on Saturday afternoon. Obviously, we've kept the best for the last. Welcome to the closing panel of the convention, which is entitled Silencing Judges or Avoiding Improper Influence. The main subject of our discussion will be Senate Bill 1638, which has been reported out to the Senate last spring from the Senate Judiciary Committee as part of the Federal Judicial Salary Restoration Act of 2008. Don't expect much discussion or controversy regarding the provisions of this act, which would adjust our salaries upwards, at least for me. But the main subject of discussion will be a provision of Section 10 of the Act, which is an additional or new definition of what are judicial gifts. And you'll see here on the PowerPoint in a minute the text with which we will be dealing. And it's a particular subsection 2 which prohibits a federal judge from accepting, quote, in connection with a single trip or event. I take it such as this convention, so I hope you all enjoyed the conversation between Judges McConnell and Posner, because it's likely to be the last one. As a reimbursement, if he attends as a speaker or participant, because I hope this is a program, a significant purpose of which is the education of federal or state judges. Since the Federal Society is dedicated to that. Also affected will be any reimbursements for any trips to legal conferences in foreign countries, for instance, Cuba, Iraq, or Russia, and indeed, after listening to Mark Stein, Canada. unless they are approved by the Department of State, quote, to promote the rule of law or developing legal systems. So in what may well be, at least my swan song, since I come from California, for federal judges' appearances at these conclaves, to say nothing of our speeches at student meetings at law schools where we learn what is going on from students, we have a distinguished panel to discuss the wisdom and perhaps the constitutionality of such an enactment. In the order in which they appear to my geographical right, Mr. Robert Schiff, who is the Democratic Chief Counsel for Senate Judiciary Committee's Subcommittee on Constitution, which is chaired by Senator Russell Feingold of Wisconsin. Mr. Schiff advises and has advised Senator Feingold on all legislative issues and judicial nominations. Before joining Senator Feingold's staff, Mr. Schiff was a staff attorney and lobbyist for Public Citizens Congress Watch. He graduated from Brown, undergraduate, and Michigan Law School, and afterwards clerked for Judge Barrington Parker, the District Court for the District of Columbia. Immediately to my right is Judge A. Raymond Randolph. Judge Randolph sits on the Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia since 1990. He is a graduate of Drexel University. Judge Randolph took his law degree from the University of Pennsylvania, where he graduated number one in his class while being the managing editor of the Law Review. Judge Randolph clerked for Judge Henry Friendly on the Second Circuit and then went on to serve in the Department of Justice and then as special assistant attorney for three Western states before entering private practice in Washington, D.C. He has argued before the Supreme Court 25 times. To my left is Professor Eugene Volokh, who is a professor of law at the UCLA Law School, and is well known to you, all of you who were here yesterday when he told us what we could say and what the restaurant owner could allow us to say in the new world of free speech. He teaches criminal law relations between church and state, and related freedom of speech law. Professor Volokh, clerk for Chief Judge Alex Kaczynski of my circuit, the Ninth Circuit, and Justice Sandra O'Connor. He has authored several textbooks on First Amendment and academic writing subjects and has published over 50 law review articles. He is the founder and co-author of the Volokh Conspiracy, a website, a weblog, which has about 25,000 hits per day. Mr. Schiff will speak for 10 minutes in support of Senator Feingold's portion of SB 1683, and then he reserves 5 minutes for a rebuttal. Judge Randolph will then speak for about 15 minutes, and then Professor Volokh for 10 or 15 minutes, and Mr. Schiff will come back for a rebuttal, and after that we'll have questions between the participants and from the audience. And with that, let me present you Mr. Robert Schiff.
Thank you very much, Judge. It's a pleasure and an honor to be here with all of you. A lot of people said that I would be like Daniel walking into the lion's den by coming here, but based on a conference call that we panelists had this week, I already know that Judge Randolph has some pretty sharp claws. But I prefer to think of this visit as reaching out and engaging with the other side in a civil fashion, as Barack Obama has suggested we need to do. As the President-elect said on election night, I will listen to you, especially when we disagree. And I think those are important words to be guided by as we start a new era in Washington. I know that you take them to heart as well, since you invited me to speak to you, so thank you again. I don't know if anyone saw a recent New York Times article on the topic we're discussing today. Let me quote a little bit of it for you. The headline is, Soros Endows New California Legal Group. George Soros announced today that with an initial $50 million gift, he will endow the Center for Constitutional Studies at the University of California at Berkeley, dedicated to the education of federal judges. In a statement announcing the gift, Mr. Soros indicated that President Obama, this is a quote, President Obama will have the opportunity in the next 4 or 8 years to remake the federal judiciary. By offering judicial education seminars, the center will ensure that new judges have the doctrinal tools and academic support needed to take on the right-wing Roberts Court. Arianna Dotler, a lawyer with the Milberg Law Firm, which specializes in securities class actions, who will serve as the center's first executive director, said the seminars will take place in a new luxury chalet to be built in the Northern California wine country in order to offer the most scenic and comfortable surroundings possible for these important seminars. It's about time that judges got to hear the other side of the coin on an expense-paid trip, she said. A staffer for Senator Russ Feingold, who authored a prohibition on such programs that cleared the Senate Judiciary Committee in the 110th Congress, had a different take. When I appeared at the Federalist Society convention in November, I said that providing expense-paid junkets to federal judges to try to influence their legal thinking is wrong, no matter who is doing it, and I still feel that way. Wait, how can that be? The date on this is, July 4th, 2009. It's from that faux New York Times thing that came out a few days after the election. Sorry about that. I'm not sure how quickly you figured out that I was making this up, but it's actually not all that far-fetched. Keep that in mind as we discuss this topic today. While the initial concerns about judicial education trips were raised by an environmental law firm, which believed foundations on the right like FREE, the Foundation for Research on Economics and the Environment, were trying to influence the bench by providing these trips, this year, the Washington Examiner reported on a group called the Institute for Law and Economic Policy, ILEP. It was formed as an academic advocate for aggressive securities class action litigation, and it invites judges to attend its conferences, such as the one held at the Doral Golf Resort and Spa in Miami, Florida, which had the theme, Protecting the Public, the Role of Private and Public Attorneys. One commentator in the article said, if Milberg Weiss and Bill Larac wanted to cultivate favorable opinion among law professors, opinion makers, and judges, they seem to have found the perfect vehicle in ILEP. Now, I don't know about you. Maybe I'm just too idealistic. But I would like to think that the judge hearing my case, if I were a plaintiff or a defendant, were deciding important cases that affect the whole nation, hasn't been fed, lobbied, or educated by groups with an interest in his decision. I want judges to reach their decisions after careful consideration of the facts and the law. Or, if I'm lucky enough to get Judge Posner, based on his conception of public policy and the best way to put that into force. I want them to be influenced by the briefs they read and the arguments they hear, not by favorable opinions of the litigants or their positions cultivated through expense-paid vacations to exotic locales. At base, the concern over judicial education trips has the same two components as the concern over gifts to member of Congress and privately paid congressional travel, both of which Senator Feingold has tried to curb over the past decade with a good deal of success. The first component is the question of undue or improper influence. Why do we not want litigants giving gifts to judges? Why don't we say, who cares if the defendant has taken the judge on a vacation the week before the trial? He promised the Senate Judiciary Committee to imply the law impartially, didn't he? Well, it's because it's just human nature to appreciate someone who gives you things. It's not much more complicated than that. We don't want members of Congress to meet only with people who offer to buy them lunch. We don't want the members of Congress to help people get tax breaks or earmarks for their constituents or lobbyists who they like because they give out free tickets to the Verizon Center or an expense-paid golfing trip to Scotland. And I don't think we want judges being influenced by groups who offer them interesting expense-paid educational programs at sunny resorts in the middle of winter. Now, the second component is the discomfort that people have with public servants seeming to profit from their positions. That's why the locations and the opulence of these trips bother people. Now, I know that many groups offer CLE credit for courses given in nice vacation spots. The location is a draw. People like to take their cough medicine in the morning and play golf or lounge on the beach in the afternoon. But we're talking here about programs specifically for federal judges. Now, I know judges are just human beings who enjoy nice resorts like everyone else. In fact, one judge told the Legal Times, I think if you want to get judges to attend, you want to do it someplace nice, frankly. If there was a course like that in Baltimore, I don't think I would go to it. No offense to Baltimore. I totally understand that sentiment, and I expect everyone in this room does too, with the possible exception of those who hail from Baltimore. But the fact remains that the taxpayers pay judges to do a very important job, and many people think it doesn't look right for judges to seem like they are taking advantage of their status to take a vacation on someone else's dime. By the way, lots of professionals in this country pay for their own continuing education, legal or otherwise. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, CLE credit is offered for many events at this conference, including this panel. Just out of curiosity, how many people here are paying for this conference out of their own pockets? That's a healthy majority, I'd say, or approximately half, perhaps. And given the high quality of programs here, especially this one, I assume that many of you who didn't raise your hands would come, even if your expenses weren't being reimbursed. I actually was happy to pay for my lunch today in order to hear two exceptional federal judges speak. I would think many judges would be insulted by the assertion that they will never do anything to further their education and training unless it is paid for by someone else. This problem has been around for a long time. Judicial education trips have been offered by the Law and Economics Center at George Mason University since the mid-1970s, and the first complaint about them was filed with a judicial conference by the Institute for Public Representation in 1982. Congressional attention to the issue dates back at least to the year 2001, when a 2020 expose, including scenes of judges on the golf course in Tucson, one of whom said, I haven't taken a vacation all year. This is my vacation, really brought the issue to the public eye. For years, even after my boss and other senators raised concerns, the judicial conference pretty much brushed off the criticism. But it finally recognized the public perception problem when it put into place disclosure requirements for education trips. Previously, under advisory opinion number 67, which was issued after that 1982 complaint, judges simply had to satisfy themselves of the propriety of taking a trip, undertaking an inquiry into the funding of a seminar only if they thought a reasonable question about the propriety of attending could be raised. Now, under the policy adopted by the Judicial Conference in September 2006, judges have to report when they take these trips, and they're not supposed to attend unless the sponsor of the trip has reported and publicly disclosed who is funding it. I think we've reached a point, however, where the perception of impropriety is so great and so pervasive that the argument over actual impropriety may be beside the point. And while disclosure alone may have been enough if it had been instituted a decade or two ago, at this point it isn't, particularly because the disclosure required by the judicial conference has several loopholes, like if the judge went on the trip in the past, she doesn't have to disclose it now, and the judge doesn't have to disclose the value of the trip, some of which are estimated at many thousands of dollars. The reform proposed by Senator Feingold and reported several months ago by the Senate Judiciary Committee is simple. Professor Volokh has helpfully summarized it on the single-page PowerPoint that you see in front of you now. Private reimbursement for judicial education trips, defined as programs a significant purpose of which is the education of federal or state judges, is prohibited. And reimbursement for travel expenses, meals, lodging, gifts, and outside income connected with other trips or events like speaking engagements or teaching is limited to $2,000 per trip and $20,000 per year. And I just might interject at this point that I certainly would not consider a federal society conference to be a program that a significant purpose of which is the education of federal or state judges. The number of judges attending these, while I'm sure is significant, is not nearly a high enough percentage for anyone to reasonably argue that this is not a conference open to the public, essentially, and judges are here like everyone else. So they would be covered under paragraph two. No, I'm sorry. They would be covered under paragraph one, not paragraph two. And the question of whether people – actually, how many people here do you think spent more than $2,000 in accommodations and travel to be here? Okay, a handful, and perhaps judges on the West Coast. But the vast majority of conferences, one-day attendance to make a speech, certainly $2,000 would be enough. And I've talked with the administrative office of the courts about setting up a system where the AO on a case-by-case basis could grant an additional amount of reimbursement if the expenses were reasonable. Identical exceptions apply to both the prohibition in the case of judicial education and the limit on reimbursements. They were taken directly from the exceptions to the judicial conference disclosure rules. The judicial conference seems to have made a decision that certain sponsors of trips would not or were unlikely to raise appearance concerns. And we thought it would be simplest and cause the least controversy, and perhaps that was naive, to simply follow its lead. So we didn't come up with these exceptions out of thin air. We took them from the Judicial Conference's own disclosure guidelines. So unlimited reimbursements from governmental bodies, state and local bar associations, subject matter bar associations, judicial association, and the Judicial Division of the American Bar Association, and the National Judicial College are permitted. The committee report indicates that the Judicial Conference's publicly available interpretations of the terms used in its policy are sensible and should be used in deciding, for example, what constitutes a subject matter bar association. And I'm sure, I hope we'll have time for questions. We can talk about particular kinds of events. But I hope I've given you a better idea of what Senator Feingold is trying to accomplish and why. And I'll reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal and retreat to take the arrows of my fellow panelists. Thank you for listening, and I appreciate it.
Judge Randolph.
This panel is misnamed. This is really a school choice panel. The Feingold Amendment says judges should go to school, but only in government schools, unless it's an ABA school. You can go to an ABA. No private school. Quite familiar with this topic. It's been going on since the early 90s, I guess. And I've dealt with it when I was chairman of the Code of Conduct Committee. And the fact that it comes up again is proof of the line from Huxley that a theory survives long after its brains have been knocked out. Yeah, everybody knows that we talked about CLA. Education's good for lawyers, and maybe it's not as well known, but education is also good for judges. But what Senator Feingold is proposing is that because he finds impropriety and deep ethical implications in judges attending judicial educational programs, that they all ought to be banned. There are two theories behind this, neither one of which holds any water, and I'll just get them out in front. One is that, oh, my God, I've been brainwashed. I went to a George Mason Law and Economics seminar, and I've come away brainwashed, so I'm going to vote in a particular way. And the other is that, oh, what a lovely vacation. And we've heard them both. What a lovely vacation. I owe you for this. The question is, number one, on the owe you, who do they owe? Who do the judges owe? And number two, where's the evidence for the brainwashing? All right. I think Senator Feingold misdiagnoses a problem that doesn't exist and offers a solution that maybe is constitutional but is awful. And I think the real problem that he has is that he fails to see, or if he sees, he fails to admit that the real objection is not about appearances of impropriety. It's about the content of the program, which he doesn't like. Judicial seminars have existed for more than 60 years. I clerked, as Judge Baez mentioned, for Henry Friendly. He went to one down in Miami, a law and economics seminar, told me that he learned a great deal from it. The question of the propriety of judges going to them seminars came up. The Code of Conduct Committee rendered an opinion. It dealt with conflicts of interest. It dealt with the location, the timing, the subject matter. And things should have been put to rest as a result of that. But instead, there was a fellow that Mr. Schiff alluded to named Douglas Kendall. And I think Mr. Schiff referred to him as the, or his organization, as a, an environmental interest organization. Actually, it's not. The name of the organization, founded in 1997, is the Community Rights Council. Not the Individual Rights Council, the Community Rights Council. And that organization consists, so far as I can tell, of two staff members with a budget about the salary of a federal judge. So it's not a real significant organization. But their pitch has been to stop judges from going to these seminars. And they're really a takings organization. They're on the side of the cities in takings cases like Kelo and others and file amicus briefs or whatever. Well, anyway, he wrote, Mr. Kendall wrote an article. He did a report about judges attending these seminars. And he was joined in the introduction by a former colleague of mine, Judge Abner Mikva, who had left the bench by then. Now, just to let you know, Judge Mikva, it turns out, is President-elect Obama's chief judicial advisor at the moment. Well, anyway, Judge Mikva wrote that judges were being entertained by private interests and who were allowed to wine and dine judges at fancy resorts under the pretext of educating them about complicated issues. Note the word pretext. The Washington Post huffed and puffed. There were a lot of Me Too editorials in the New York Times and elsewhere. And there was a bill introduced. It was introduced on the sponsorship of Senator Kerry and Senator Feingold, and the bill went nowhere. The Chief Justice opposed it, the Judicial Council opposed it, the Federal Bar Association opposed it, the committee that I was chairman of opposed it, and so on and so forth. Well, now the committee is now controlled by the Democrats, the Senate Judiciary Committee, and Senator Feingold, in a 10-9 vote, got his amendment through. There were no hearings on it. There was no factual development. Everything that Mr. Schiff said is not, nothing that Mr. Schiff said is from any kind of evidentiary inquiry by the committee. A lot of it relied on, as Mr. Schiff pointed out, a 2020 program. So the Senate Judiciary Committee for its ethical supports is relying on Barbara Walters and Brian Ross. And they put this in the committee report. You read the committee report, and they cite 2020. Well, I want to tell you a little bit about that program. I'm not going to go too much, but here it is. The program begins with video footage of Tucson, Arizona. It's a warm day in Tucson. And there's a few old guys milling around. They're friends of mine. They're going to forgive me for saying this, but they're milling around a golf cart. And then the voiceover begins with the Honorable Brian Ross, and he says, 3 o'clock on a glorious Tuesday afternoon in Tucson, Arizona. It's the middle of the workday for most people. Wow. But here, at one of the top golf courses in the country, a group of U.S. federal judges, their courtrooms in black robes far away, is finishing up on the ninth hole. I mean, Brian Ross, afternoon, across the fairway, two other federal judges from Iowa, where it was cold and snowy on this December day, are heading for a tough par five. All part of an educational program that others call an entirely inappropriate junket. Now, pay close attention to the word inappropriate. Others say, who are the others in the 2020 program? Turns out there are only two, Douglas Kendall and Abner Mikveh. I want to digress. I've been to this golf course. It's Tucson National. I never play there. It's a dog track. Forget it. I play golf. When I go to Tucson, I play at an LPGA, the Women's Tour stop. It's called the Randolph Course. Terrific course. They have these hats, and it says Randolph, established 1923. I have a couple of them. You know, people think I look young for my age. I wear. But anyway. Well, anyway, the notion that this is all part of a educational program, it was a George Mason Law and Economics, was a lie. Brian Ross knew it was a lie. I talked to his producer for an hour before the program was even formulated. They knew it was a lie, but they put it out anyway. I've always believed that what students do and what students' judges do in their free time after classes is their business. The judges in this program were paying for their greens fees. And if you believe that's part of an educational program, as Senator Feingold apparently does, it's in the committee report, then you have to believe that when you go out tonight, go down M Street, and you'll see all the students from Georgetown bar hopping, right, going from one bar to the other. That's part of the educational program of Georgetown University. All right. Well, the committee report, while invoking 2020, neglects a source, and it's a case called In Re Aguinda. I saw Judge Lope, Dennis Jacobs here tonight, and it's an opinion from the Second Circuit. It deals with this very subject. It deals with free. It deals with whether a district judge properly sat on a case after attending a conference in free, one of the donors of which was the Texaco Corporation, which was responsible for 1% of the entire, and the Second Circuit goes through all of the ethical implications, all of the possible conflicts of interest, and says it was perfectly proper for Judge Rakoff to sit on the case. That's not mentioned in the committee report. There's an ethical rule that guides judges, and it's too bad it doesn't apply to the Senate. And it says before you start putting out theories, you ought to gather the facts. Now, I'm a fan of Sherlock Holmes, and Holmes said the same thing. He said, you know, it's a capital mistake, Watson, to theorize before you have the evidence. The Senate Judiciary Committee, and in particular Senator Feingold, didn't have the evidence. Let's talk about George Mason. I know George Mason pretty well. I teach there. I'm on the board of the Law and Economics Center Judicial Advisory Board. What is it? It's a state university. Who devises the programs for George Mason? The faculty does, and the Judicial Advisory Committee. Who are the donors? Who is this mysterious group that I've been brainwashed by, or on behalf of, and that I owe if I had a vacation? Who are these donors? Well, last year there were 180 donors to the George Mason Law and Economics Program, Education of Judges. Out of the 180, guess who 130 were? Judges. Judges. Their foundations and their corporations, they gave less than 10% of all of the money. And no foundation and no corporation gave more than one point some percent to the George Mason program for the year. So now, if you're Senator Feingold or his staffer, or you're a federal judge at one of these programs and you have a computer in your hand, you can figure out that the XYZ Corporation, you owe them because they're responsible for the cost of the cup of ice or the glass of iced tea you're drinking while you're listening to some professor give a regression analysis lecture. That's what it comes down to. Who do you owe? You owe your fellow judges mostly because they're the ones that have contributed. Now, I've been around the, and I've mentioned that the that the seminar programs throughout have been around for 60 years. And it's not just George Mason. It's not just this Foundation for Research on Economics and the Environment in Montana, which is affiliated with Montana State University. There's also Princeton puts these programs on, Stanford, the University of Virginia, others are involved. There's the Einstein Institute. I went to one of those on DNA. I mean, what's the politics of DNA? How am I biased for DNA? And Northwestern has just put on begun a program in conjunction with the Brookings Institute. Judge Mitva admitted when he wrote about this that he went to seminars put on by the Aspen Institute. They're not just for judicial education; they're for and Justice Harry Blackmun went every year when he was on the court. Judge Mitva says, and Mr. Kendall says, and I suppose Senator Feingold says, that those are okay. They're not junkets. Now, Judge Mitva explains that by saying, because they're mostly, which means not always, mostly about the great books. Well, you know, some people think that The Wealth of Nations was a great book. And the law and economics program is not just big, you know, about the great books, and it's not just in Tucson, Arizona. I went to another one. It was in the garden spot of the country. It was called New Haven, Connecticut. We had one. And it was about Thucydides, and it was by Donald Kagan, the Sterling Professor of Classics, the leading scholar on the Peloponnesian War. I'm not all about that. But anyway, but I did go to two other conferences at George. One of them was on Shakespeare, the Roman plays, and run by a professor who's a leading Shakespeare scholar. It was about that seminar wouldn't meet Judge Mikva's test. It wouldn't meet Senator Feingold's test either because they were just plays. It was Antony and Cleopatra and Julius Caesar and Coriolanus. And the second one I went to was run by historians of renown, Pulitzer Prize winners from MIT, Yale, Harvard. It was about the founders. And that wouldn't qualify either because Washington and Jefferson and Hamilton and Madison, they were just great men. They didn't write books. Well, actually, Jefferson, he wrote a book, but that doesn't count, Notes on the State of Virginia, because he didn't want to publish. But anyway, yeah. I'm being facetious to make a point. The point is that what we're talking about is not the content. We're talking about the perceived content and the concern. The way to stop the stifled debate is to shut down the conferences. And that's what they want to shut down George Mason, and they want to shut down Free. And that, to me, is, whether it's constitutional or not, is a terrible, terrible testament to the power of a very small firm, not a public interest firm, and a senator who's been persistent for 20 years and finally slipped one through. There's a massive contradiction in all of this. I think that the contradiction is that on the one hand it's all whining and dining, and we heard that rhyme, and on the other hand we're being indoctrinated, as if federal judges don't have the sense that every time they have any kind of education, it ought to be through the adversary system with both sides represented. That's utter nonsense. We have, I can assure you from experience, and I'll wrap up this way, that after 6 years on the Code of Conduct Committee, I don't think there's another group of public servants in the United States that are more ethical and more attuned to following the ethical prescriptions than the federal judges of this country. I'm proud of them. Every year, the Code of Conduct Committee quietly sends out, in response to inquiries, 150 to 200 letters before judges take action. We used to get letters about conferences and seminars and so on and so forth. I don't know of a single instance where after the committee reviewed it, found no conflicts, found that it was fine and comported, that the judge, or found that it wasn't, that the judge went ahead and went to the conference anyway. We don't need Senator Feingold and Barbara Walters to tell us what is ethical. We know.
Yes, please. Could you put up the PowerPoint? So I was asked to say a little about some of the policy issues raised here and also about the constitutional questions. I'm going to start with the constitutional questions. Pardon? Sorry. I'm going to start with the constitutional questions, which I think are interesting. I'm not sure how far the constitutional objections to this go, but I leave it to you to decide. One question that arises here is it permissible for Congress to try to regulate the behavior of federal judges, or is that a violation of the separation of powers? I'm not a separation of powers scholar, but I'm inclined to say that there's not much of a separation of powers problem here. I think there might be if Congress were trying to affect the actual judicial conduct of a judge, certainly if it were the Congress were to tell a judge how to rule in a particular case. Likewise, if you can imagine some possible rules that unduly intrude into judges' actual judicial behavior. Some of this conduct is not unrelated to the judicial to judges' conduct in office. Specifically, with regard to judicial education, I could certainly see why a judge might want to, so that he can better decide future cases, want to learn more about statistics or about law and economics or about original meaning or historical analysis or what have you. Nonetheless, I don't see this as the kind of regulation of actual exercise of the judicial power that would pose significant separation of powers problems. The next question is whether this poses First Amendment problems. And here's how it might. So first, the court has quite clearly said repeatedly and in many different contexts that the First Amendment protects speaking and protects listening. And in particular, because in many situations to be able to convey your message effectively, you need to spend money. It protects the spending of money for speech purposes. Some people try to recast this as money as speech. I think that's just a weird sort of glibness. It's kind of like asking, well, let's assume, I know this conference you have to say assume, for purposes of argument, there's a right to abortion. And imagine that a legislature were to say, well, okay, you can have an abortion, but you can't pay any money for it. You have to get it for free from volunteers. I take it we would agree that, assuming there's a right to an abortion, that unconstitutionally burdens the right to abortion, but not because money is abortion. It's because a restriction on the use of money for purposes of getting an abortion is a restriction on abortion. The same thing if they were to say, well, you know, you can hire a lawyer, but only pay him $2,000. Or you can send your kids to school, but you can't pay any money for the private school. So there is a potential constitutional problem here, and here's how it might come up. Imagine that, for instance, organization, let's say a university, let's say, just to leave government speech out of it, let's say USC, much as I hate to say it, University of Southern California, decides it wants to communicate the views of its faculty about interesting and important questions, let's even say purely methodological questions, to judges. If it is told that it cannot pay money for that, including for reimbursement of judges, then in that case, that would burden its ability, would make it harder for it to communicate its message, because in order to speak directly to people, you need to have them be there, and you're more likely to be able to do that if you can say, look, you know, you don't have to pay out of pocket for that. So I do think there's a First Amendment question here. The question is whether there is, in fact, a First Amendment violation here, because it's not the case that all restrictions on the payment of money are unconstitutional. We see, albeit controversially, in Buckley v. Valeo, some restrictions have been upheld. But also, the fact is, judges are government employees of a certain sort. Although, even as to government employees, the Supreme Court has held in the National Treasury Employees Union that certain restrictions, even on honoraria, not just reimbursements, but on honoraria to government employees, are unconstitutional. So what you'd have to do for First Amendment analysis is first ask, are judges just like ordinary employees, or are they, by virtue of their special constitutional status, entitled to more First Amendment protection than ordinary employees are? There's a case called Bond v. Floyd, which says that legislators aren't just ordinary employees, and can't, their speech can't just be restricted by their legislature, the same way that employees' speech can in some measure be. So you'd have to ask that. And then in the process, you'd have to, then afterwards, you'd have to ask whatever the standard of scrutiny is here, to what extent does this restriction, even if it burdens speech, still permissible? For example, you'd ask if this restriction is content-based or content-neutral, and you'd ask also whether there is, if, for example, government judges are treated as government employees, whether the interests of the government outweigh the interests of the employee, a speaker, or a listener. I just want to give you the map, because I actually can't tell you any more specifically about how it's likely to come out. The status of judges as government employees has not been well resolved. Justice Kennedy signaled that in the state judicial election speech case in Republican Party v. White. But we can't say with any real confidence how it'll come out. I just want to give you the map. I should say there's a probably pretty fair bet that if this were enacted, this would probably be held constitutional. But maybe not, and this and the reason why it might not be relates to some of the policy questions I'm about to get into, because some of them also bear on the question of whether this is being restricted because of the content of speech, which makes this more likely to be unconstitutional, or for reasons unrelated to content. So let me just quickly run through what I see as three possible government interests that we've heard something about. One possible interest is making sure that judges don't get super posh perks as a consequence of their being in office. The theory being, look, we pay them a certain amount of money, and they shouldn't enrich themselves further as a result of their government status. The difficulty is that's very hard to explain the item two here that way, because obviously if UCLA wants to invite somebody and give them a really posh posh trip, I'm sorry, I don't know what the music is. In any case, it can pay them $2,000. If other organizations, including, for example, General Subject Matter Bar Associations, the Los Angeles County Bar Association, or the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, wanted to do that, they could spend even more than $2,000. So it's very odd to see number two as being justified by that interest. The law seems pretty strikingly under-inclusive with regard to that interest, which makes it quite one doubt that that's the interest involved. A second possible interest is we want to make sure that people, that judges aren't influenced, not in the sense that influenced in favor of a particular litigant, because none of this involves payment for litigants, but in favor of a particular point of view because the exponents of the point of view have been really nice to them. Again, very hard to see this justified. The ACLU can invite a judge, the Federalist Society can invite a judge, either of them can give them their medal, the ACLU medal for wonderful actions on Eighth Amendment issues. They could do all sorts of things like that. That in some measure, with judges being human, may influence them to some extent. We certainly hope that they won't influence them materially, but it's certainly possible in these kinds of situations. But none of that justifies item two, because if the concern is that you're somehow beholden to somebody who's paid for a nice vacation for you, that's just as applicable regardless of whether it has to do with a program of education of judges. In fact, it's less so with a program for education of judges, because most of the programs for education of judges involve a lot of sitting inside rooms hearing stuff that is interesting academically, but is actually pretty difficult. UCLA can invite a judge and pay him $2,000 just to give a talk, and then the rest of the time is his own. The National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers can invite him for an even posher vacation, because remember, they're excluded from any of these limits. So then again, the judge maybe gives one talk and that's it. Whereas in these education seminars, the judge has to pay for the dubious privilege of being flown out and being put up at a hotel. Pay in the sense of having to actually do a lot of reading and a lot of listening. So the third interest, and with this I will close, the third interest, which we have heard mentioned, is the worry that the judges are going to hear things that will affect their decision-making. Now, of course, these are things they already are pretty sympathetic to in some measure, because they had to volunteer to take the time out of, of their life to go out there and do that. If somebody's going to a law and economics seminar, they're probably already kind of open to law and economics. But yes, they will hear things that may influence their future behavior. That's an interest that in First Amendment law we call sort of a content-based justification. It doesn't necessarily focus on a particular kind of thing, but it does focus on the fear that the content of the speech, whatever the content may be, will unduly influence judges. And one question is, to what extent is Congress, is it wise for Congress to, and what extent is Congress empowered to essentially restrict a judge's ability to be reimbursed, not even compensated in terms of an honorarium, but even reimbursed for trips because of a fear that they will learn things that somehow we don't want them to learn. And then the last component of that, though, is, as Judge Randolph pointed out, some people are apparently just fine if they try to teach them things. So if a federal government or state or local government, but not a public educational institution, I take it because Judge George Mason, but it covers UCLA and lots of other other educational institutions as well, but if some other part of a government wants judges to learn certain things, that's just fine. Now, we heard that, and this may just be pure coincidence, but it reminded me that apparently one of the groups involved here is related to cities acting as regulators of property, and that just reminds us that governments have their own ideological agendas too, and they needn't even be the federal government's ideological agenda. So they may. So if a government wants to have a judicial education symposium on whatever, having to do with its own interest, state sovereign immunity, or the importance of regulation and why it's not a taking, perfectly free to do that. Now, you might say, well, there's a check on that because the government may not get the funds. But as I said, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers is perfectly free to do that, too. They're a subject matter bar association. I mean, I suppose maybe what George Mason has to do is has to reorganize as the Arlington, Virginia Bar Association specializing in academic legal subjects, and then they'd be able to do that. I don't know. I mean, it's doable. We're all lawyers. Look, this is the kind of thing we do for a living. But in any event, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers is free to do this. Other groups are free to do this. The ABA is not as obviously tied to a particular ideology as the NACDL in its name, but obviously bar associations have their own views. ABA famously expresses its views. They're entitled to have their own views. There's nothing wrong with their having their own views, although, of course, members might question the views and question whether an organization should, whether it's wise for an organization such to have those views. But the fact is those organizations are free to convey those views, and others can't. And so that's certainly a speaker-based classification, and in some measure I take it somewhat correlated to content, because if our worry is that judges will be indoctrinated, and somehow those groups, it's not a problem with indoctrinating them, and note the distinction may be drawn from disclosure requirements. This goes way, way beyond disclosure requirements. This is a total prohibition on any reimbursement for these kinds of educational seminars. So presumably the reason some are in or some are out, my guess would have something to do with whether the backers of the legislation like or dislike the indoctrination that is involved. So those are some of the reasons I'm pretty worried about this. Some of them may also play into the First Amendment analysis to the extent that you see them as content-based and speaker-based, but perhaps content-justified restrictions that might, in fact, make this a First Amendment violation, especially the more you treat judges as being even more protected by the First Amendment, or perhaps at least as protected by the First Amendment as other government employees. With this, I close and turn things over to Mr. Schiff for his rebuttal.
Mr. Schiff, we're going to give you an extra 5 minutes. Don't worry.
Go ahead. Great. I may not take it. I thought I was doing pretty good with my jokes, and then I heard your response to Judge Randolph and realized that I had fallen completely flat in my presentation. let me just respond to a few things. First of all, you heard many times in many different ways the suggestion that we want to ban certain programs. We want to shut down certain kinds of programs by certain groups. If you look at that, well, hi. If you look at the text, there's no ban in there. We're talking here about reimbursement. And from the show of hands, when I asked the question about people coming here, there are plenty of people in this country who pay for their own continuing education. And I just don't think it's particularly persuasive that all judicial education programs, except those run by the accepted entities, and we'll talk about those and why they're there in a second, will dry up completely. And that's saying basically the judges have to be paid, have to be reimbursed for everything they do. Judges think they deserve more money than they make, and they probably do, but they certainly make a lot more money than many lawyers who pay for their own continuing legal education out of their desire to improve their professional capabilities and their responsibility as lawyers to do that. So no ban. Just we're talking here about reimbursement, and that really goes to the appearance and the actual influence of certain kinds of reimbursements. Let's talk about the 2020 program. This is probably the longest time that a 2020 program has survived in the public memory of any of them in their history. I'm sure Barbara Walters and Brian Ross would be thrilled to see us discussing this. I went back and watched it, actually, just to correct Judge Randolph. They actually played the part where the people who were playing golf said, we pay our own greens fees. There was no suggestion that the golf was included. There was also certainly no suggestion that the golf was part of the education, and that was somehow wrong. Everybody knows that when you go to a resort for a program of some kind, you take your program, and then you get the benefits of the resort. And you may have to pay extra for certain things. You may not. There certainly are some of these trips that involve recreational activities that are included in the trip. I don't think that Judge Randolph would deny that. In this particular case, they were paying their own greens fees. They were not paying their own rooms. They were not paying their own airfare. There was plenty of reimbursement involved here beyond the golf. Now, let's talk a little bit about the exceptions. Public educational institutions. It's fine for Professor Volokh to speculate that we included public educational institutions because we wanted to get George Mason, and they're public, and so we had to include public. Actually, the Judicial Conference includes public educational institutions as not included in the exceptions for the disclosure rules, and I think that's because they didn't want, and I don't think we want either, to discriminate against private educational institutions and somehow treat them differently. The same thing for discussion of subject matter bar associations. There's a definition that the Judicial Conference has provided. I'll read it to you. Subject matter bar association, an association of lawyers who practice in a specific area of the law, such as administrative, admiralty, antitrust, elder, immigration, or patent law. Associations of lawyers whose members comprise or frequently represent the same side in litigation are not considered to be subject matter bar associations for purposes of this policy. So just to lay aside any misinterpretation, the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers would not be a subject matter bar association that could comply with this, that would be accepted currently from the disclosure rules and that would be accepted from the new provision. The Federalist Society and the American Constitution Society, I don't think would be considered subject matter bar associations either. They could not put on programs specifically to educate federal judges. They could put on their annual conferences and invite judges to attend and reimburse them for up to $2,000 in expenses, and possibly for more if we work out something because of people who come from the West Coast or are otherwise unable to have reasonable expenses and actually attend. Let's see, I'm not even sure the ABA would be accepted. The provision specifically talks about
the Judicial Division of the ABA?
The Judicial Division, sorry, of the American Bar Association. So that's this particular section of the American Bar Association, but I don't think that the ABA generally all of a sudden is exempt. And the Judicial Division, in terms of putting on education for judges, would be permitted to do that, as would the National Judicial College. Again, these were not choices made by Senator Feingold or anyone else in the Congress. This was the exceptions that were drawn up by the Judicial Conference when it put together its disclosure rules. I guess the last thing I want to say is that it's a lot of fun to ridicule a proposal and a senator. There was wonderful laughter when people were ascribing certain views to Senator Feingold and what he must think about Shakespeare or anything else. You know, this is a great group of people here, but there is a large public out there that doesn't see things in the kind of, you know, snarky way that we do. And I think that people make a mistake to just downplay and denigrate anyone who would think that judges ought not to be taking these kinds of trips on someone else's dime when they're public service. And we are very interested in working out something that people can live with, that will allow judicial education to continue. There are a variety of ways that that could be done. This is not the last word. But we're not going away just because you make fun of it and just because the judges don't like it. So I really appreciate the opportunity to explain a little bit to you all, and hopefully the conversation will continue, whether people want to engage in it in a serious way or not. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, before we open up the microphones to members of the public, perhaps the other two. You can have. You want to start a rebuttal?
I have respect for any senator. I don't believe that the public gives a damn about this subject. I'm surprised this room is even.
It's a plenary. We have a captive audience.
Yeah, I know.
CLE credit.
You notice how many times the presidential candidates mention judicial seminars and how many. It's just not in the radar screen. I want to correct one thing that Mr. Schiff said. He said that that on the 2020 program that there was no claim that golf was part of the seminar. Well, I have the transcript from the program because the producer sent it to me afterwards, and I will read it again. At the swimming pool, after talking about golf and so on, there's a federal judge from Ohio doing laps, while another one from California leisurely catches up on some Sun and newspapers, all part of an educational program that others call an entirely inappropriate junket. That's the transcript. And it's repeated, that is repeated in the Senate committee report, which talks about the educational program involving swimming laps, sunbathing, and judges playing golf. That's in your committee report. Now, the other thing that Mr. Schiff said that I have to take issue with is that we're not preventing judges from going to seminars. We're just saying they can't be reimbursed, right? I am a fan of Samuel Johnson. It's not just, could you put that, whoever's doing it, could you put that thing up here again? I want to point out a couple of things. It's not just the judges going. You can't even get reimbursed to speak at a seminar. And I'm a fan of Samuel Johnson, and I believe what he said. You know, Samuel Johnson said that no man but a blockhead ever wrote except for money. And I think there's a message. I think there's a message there. I am not going to go give a speech at UCLA on my own ticket. I am not going to go give a speech at Yale on my own ticket. And the fact of the matter is the $2,000 reimbursement would not cover our great moderator's expenses being here at the Mayflower Hotel for 3 days, flown in from California, and free meals. He wouldn't be able to do it unless you wanted to pay your own way. There is absolutely nothing wrong with the reimbursement. And there's nothing wrong with having the judges' seminars in a warm climate. Number one, judges fly in from all over the country. If George Mason had all their conferences here in Washington, it would be more expensive. The hotels here are more expensive. Tucson in December is less expensive than here, and the judges are going to fly in anyway. And besides that, the objection here is not, it could not be cured if every conference that George Mason held was held in January in Iowa in a cornfield. That's not what we're dealing with here. The problem is the misperceived notion that the content is bad. And we haven't heard much about that because we have at George Mason, we have Nobel Prize winning economists, Pulitzer Prize winning historians, leading professors from all of the leading universities and law schools in the country teaching these courses. So it's not a and it's misperception of content that is really driving this. And I think that the professor is quite right that if that can be proven, then there is a serious First Amendment problem.
I just want to make three basically factual and narrow points. One is, so the ABA, the Judicial Division, is covered. So are state bar associations and local bar associations. So perhaps ABA, other than through Judicial Division, wouldn't be able to fund it, though I can't really see
why it couldn't fund whatever it wants through the judicial division. But certainly the California has a state bar, but any states that have a non-integrated state bars and presumably also voluntary bar associations like the Los Angeles County Bar Association would be free to do that no matter how opinionated they may be. And it's not surprising, by the way, that lawyers in particular cities and states may be even more opinionated on average than the country as a whole. As to subject matter bar associations, it's an interesting question. Perhaps I was wrong to suggest the American Trial Lawyers Association would be covered, but I would think the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers would be covered in part because this specifically mentions immigration law being a specific subject matter. Immigration law, like criminal law, is a field in which at least the private lawyers, the non-governmental lawyers, are all on one side. The very fact that it mentions immigration law suggests that a National Association of Immigration Lawyers, which my guess is almost exclusively would be populated by private practice immigration lawyers rather than by lawyers who work for the government in immigration law, would be covered. If you really want to exclude the NACDL, which, again, I would be surprised if it's excluded, it's certainly easy to imagine lots of subject matter groups that have, because of the volume of their membership or because of their history, have particular kinds of political skews to them. In fact, my guess is that virtually every one of them does, in fact, have a political skew, at least on those issues that matter to it, simply because different parts of the bar are differently represented on different groups. The last thing, the show of hands is an example of something that perhaps a good judicial education seminar would forewarn against, and that is selection bias. When we're seeing a show of hands, we're seeing a show of hands of those people who were willing to pay their own way here and who actually came here. There are lots of other people, I take it, who aren't willing to pay their own way because they may not have the money.
Especially judges.
Exactly. And from my own field, professors as well. So what we're not seeing is the number of people out there who might have gone to some place if their way had been paid, but didn't go because they couldn't. I will tell you, as a professor, my way to conferences, even when it's not paid by the conference organizers, is paid for by my school. I imagine many firms, for at least various kinds of lawyer education, pay for their lawyers to go. Understandable. Why? Because if you want to translate in First Amendment terms, if you want to foster a certain kind of speech, or if you want to allow people to foster that kind of speech, it helps if the burden of receiving the speech, the financial burden of receiving the speech, or financial burden of giving the speech, is diminished. Conversely, if you want to suppress a particular kind of speech, if you want to make a particular kind of speech not illegal, but a lot less likely to happen, one way you might do that is by making sure that even when there's a willing organization, whether in some situations the employer, in this situation, given the employer is the taxpayers, it would be the organizer of the event, even when the organization is willing to make it easier for judges to come reimbursing them for their out-of-pocket expenses, you bar them from doing that, and that will be a very reliable way of diminishing the kind of speech that you think is fraught with whatever difficulties you think it's fraught with.
Before we get to the...
No, I'm sorry. I would think that...
Do you have a comment, Bob? Or?
No. Go back and forth a lot. As far as what bar associations are covered, we obviously don't know. We took this from, and I'm saying we in the collective we here, we took this from the Judicial Conference's guidelines. They made a judgment about certain bar associations not causing as much of an appearance problem, I think, because they were requiring disclosure in order to address this appearance problem. And I just don't know whether the defense lawyers, I think the Immigration Bar Association probably do have government lawyers involved, but I don't know that for sure. So that's an open question. But again, you can't draw any implication of what our intent was, what kind of groups we were trying to silence or encourage or permit from the exceptions, because we didn't design them. We took them in order to try to avoid this kind of controversy.
But you voluntarily adopted them. You could have had no exceptions. You could have had other exceptions, but those are the ones you decided to adopt.
Right. Okay. One question before we get to the public, which has a particular interest to...
Let me make one other comment to Judge Randolph. I know you wouldn't go to Yale on your own dime to speak, but you don't have to, because $2,000 will get you up there. So I understand that there are some problems with the transportation costs,
There's a limit of $2,000. If I give a speech about the rule of law to Albania and the State Department approves it, there's no limit. But if I go to Yale to give the same speech, there's a limit of $2,000. Now, as between Albania and Yale, I'm not sure which one needs the speech more.
And if Judge Randolph wants to give a speech to a group of judges, then there's no reimbursement allowed at all, unless he does it through the approved organizations.
That's true.
But one question.
We're only talking about that.
Obviously self-interested. Suppose a judge thumbs his nose at this and says, I'm going to take a reimbursement anyway. Is this a violation of some federal statute for which he can be criminally prosecuted, or is it simply the basis for impeachment?
I don't think this is an amendment to Title 18, so I'm not that familiar with judges thumbing their noses at the law, but I guess it happens.
All right. But
it's not a criminal.
Questions from the audience. You first, sir.
I think John Rowland of the Constitution Society. We should remind ourselves of the apocryphal quote attributed to either Lyndon Johnson or Hubert Humphrey, that we should not judge laws by the intents of their framers, but by the ways in which they may be maladministered. Now, we only have excerpts of this today, but from my reading of it, I see a number of obvious problems. First of all, it does not allow, apparently, for cost of living adjustments.
If we have
1,000% inflation, it would cover it.
So adjust it for inflation.
Okay.
Yeah. Would you please frame a question, sir?
Okay. This would seem to exclude judges teaching in law schools, because it doesn't necessarily say sitting judges. It could be future judges. It could be any gathering in which there's at least one judge present.
Well, maybe that's a question. What do you think, Mr. Schiff?
I suppose it's an argument a lawyer could make. I don't think it's particularly persuasive that it would apply to any class given by a judge at a law school, because there are future judges in the audience.
It
does. The committee report specifically acknowledges that it applies to judges' teaching.
No, but it applies to judges' teaching, but he was saying that it would be a judicial education trip that would be completely, reimbursement would be prohibited because there are future judges in the audience. That was the point, right? Oh. Yes, it certainly applies to teaching. It applies, and the committee report makes it clear each class is a single event, so it would not be a $2,000 limit on teaching an entire semester course. There's already, a $24,000 cap on outside income for teaching. Okay.
But what would prevent whoever enforces it, let's say it's a U.S. attorney, from saying to the judge, we suspect you may be violating this. We're going to audit you every week looking for violations unless you just happen to decide to resign so we can fill your seat with a new appointee. Couldn't this be used abusively as a tool to clear the federal bench for the new administration?
I think even my opponents up here wouldn't.
I would firmly say no.
Don't hold back. All right. Yeah, would you please identify yourself?
Peter Daly, Canisius College, Buffalo, New York. I have a question I'd like you to take back to the committee or the Senate. It's a concern we have as a small college, and I think this is a concern that many small colleges have. We have a lecture series at the college, as do a number of other small colleges. It's a lecture series that involves bringing in many judges as well as other prominent people in the field of legal, the law. Now, it's not a prominent college. So if we bring someone in, we need to pay them enough to get them there. It's not like getting to a resort. We've had a number of speakers, judges on both sides of the issue, one of which was Abner Mikveh. We think it would make it difficult for us to be able to pay the kind of fees that you're suggesting here is a limit to get judges here in a reasonable sense. This is a concern I have. It's not something I'm opposed entirely to what you're doing, but I think Many small colleges have that legitimate concern, and we hope you would take that back as a consideration for any changes in this bill. Thank you.
Let me just respond to the question, and I'd be happy to hear what you have to say about it. Absolutely, it's a concern. I think the concern that we have are that judges are charging for their speeches an exorbitant amount, up to $5,000 and $10,000. Sorry, there's murmurs in the crowd, but these are federal employees. Their job is to be judges. If they want to go out and give a speech, that is terrific. We're glad that they do, but $5,000 or $10,000 payment, not expenses, but a payment, is excessive. And there are only a handful of judges that can command that kind of reimbursement, and it's just not something that we're prepared to go along with. Now, I will say, when people contacted me from the West Coast about the limit and talked about the cost of airfare, I said, please show me some documentation of expenses, reasonable expenses that you paid, not $500 a night hotel rooms necessarily, but airfare and a reasonable rate hotel room, and let me see what the evidence is. And nobody sent in anything to us. In fact, some of them said, well, that's private information. So if in fact, you know, beyond the payment from your small college, there are difficulties because of transportation, that's certainly something that we would be happy to look at.
Mr. Schiff, I'm just puzzled. So you're talking about $5,000 to $10,000. That's a considerable amount of money, although I suppose that a small college would say, well, it's true, Yale and Harvard can bring people in because people like the idea of talking to Yale and Harvard audiences. D.C. might bring people in because people have friends around there, but if we're in Buffalo, we've got to pay some amount of money. And if the judges, even ones who just aren't sort of in it to try to enrich themselves, you know, they decide when you have 10 invitations, one of the things you look to is the honorarium being paid. The college is in a position where they may not even be able to pay $1,000. I mean, $1,000 is what the Federalist Society gives faculty members, for example, just to come and give a talk. I mean, it's not out of the norm.
I didn't get that.
Well, see if ACS is willing to pay the same amount. I mean, it's
here.
So I'm just wondering why the concern about $5,000 or $10,000 honorarium translates into a rule, proposed rule that says $2,000 cap for transportation plus hotel. Transportation and hotel very easy to be $1,000 plus just right there. Plus an honorarium. I mean, if you were concerned about $5,000 or $10,000 honorarium, you could certainly say reimbursement of up to $2,000 and an honorarium of no more than $2,000. So it's hard for me to see why the concern about the very large numbers justifies this really quite small number.
Can I comment? This is an example. The answer to this question is an example of why legislation should not be put in without a thoroughgoing factual investigation. There's an honorarium ban on federal judges accepting money for speeches.
Oh, there is.
When I was on the committee,
back everything I just said.
What are we talking about? Tell me who these federal judges are that are getting $5,000 and $10,000.
I would be happy to, but I'm not going to do it in this public forum. I'll be happy to tell you.
But there's
not
no
getting it for honorarium.
Can I finish?
But I just want to make clear. They're not getting it for honorarium. They are being paid for teaching, a lecture fee. It's a single lecture, and they call it teaching.
Okay. Well, teaching is a different deal. I don't know. But the second thing is that the gentleman raised a very good question. In fact, as I recall, the Association of Deans of Law School wrote to your committee protesting this legislation, saying that it was totally against their effort to have judges come to their law school and teach students, and so that students can learn directly from the judges, you know, about the judicial process. Is that right or not? They didn't have an opportunity to testify to that because the bill was just slipped on through in the middle of the night.
Your next question, sir. State your name and where you're from.
Sure. Rob Cascone. I'm the president of the student chapter at Thomas Cooley Law School in Lansing, Michigan, which is neither warm nor picturesque. But what really concerns me about the bill is the aggregate cap of 20,000 or 10 trips a year. I can tell you, being the president, every year I send out about 60 invitations to members of the society to come and speak, and from that I fill 12 to 16 spots. So being that there's an aggregate cap and being that it's hard enough to get judges with their busy dockets, it's now an added deterrence for judges to come because they do have to pick, do I want to go to Harvard, Yale, Columbia, or do I want to go to Lansing, Michigan and speak to Thomas Cooley Law School? So I was wondering what your thoughts would be on that.
It's a fair point. Again, I don't know how many judges travel, 10, 12 times a year at $2,000 a piece. And to the extent that it cuts back on some smaller schools being able to get somebody, that's unfortunate. There are a lot of federal judges in the country. And one of the things that we've been hearing about is people judging moot court competitions. Well, maybe moot court competitions can be judged by the local federal district court judges and not always the D.C. Circuit judges or the Supreme Court judges who they want to bring in and who will be happy to take the reimbursement. So, but I think it's a fair point. And, the legislative process, you made a number of comments about the legislative process, Judge Randolph, and one thing you said was the bill went nowhere the first time it was introduced. That, of course, can be said about lots of legislation. It takes time.
I wish we could say it about this one. But
we said it. We said it. It went nowhere the first time. This is an ongoing process, and I can promise you that we will have a hearing on this topic, and we'll get a chance to talk about some of these things in more detail. But the comments are good ones.
Before we get to Professor Hellman, I didn't see you in the back because the lights are in my eyes, but you've been standing there for quite a while. You have a question?
Yeah, thanks so much. For Mr. Schiff, first, we really appreciate your coming here today, and you're right, it is easy. It's easy to be snarky and make fun of Senator Feingold, so I will. don't we know for a certainty from the way you opened your comments today that this is content suppression? Why else would you have used that anecdote about George Soros flying people into the Napa Valley? You think we're going to be afraid of that, and I can think I speak for everyone in this room. The Federalist Society couldn't care less how many judges are flown away by George Soros because we want to fight it out in the marketplace of ideas. Now, look, we know something about, I'll have a question in one second, please. So I know something about how Senator Feingold thinks, because he is the joint author with our Republican presidential nominee of the abomination known as McCain-Feingold, the unprincipled piece of legislation that sucked money out of the state political parties, so it went right into the 527s. And Eugene Volokh was joking about this, but again, I don't think there's anyone in this room that can't think of how that this could be overturned and distorted in the way it is administered. That is, in the extremely unlikely event that a court should determine that this is a piece of legislation which is in keeping with the public interest as they ascertain it, which I doubt.
Very nice.
You are free to comment or go on to the next question.
I only opened with that anecdote to try to dispel the notion that this was only somehow about getting conservative organizations that were trying to brainwash judges, and that's the only reason. I agree with you entirely that it ought to be thought out in the marketplace of ideas, not money. And that, I guess, is where we disagree, that I'm not comfortable with interest groups on all sides flying judges to dude ranches in Montana for a week of vacation and education and fight it out in the marketplace about which side of the education works better. I want judges to judge and to do their education in ways that seem a little bit less like they're feathering their own nests. And so that's our goal. I'll refrain from defending McCain-Feingold. The RNC immediately after Senator McCain's defeat filed suit again against the law. So I guess we'll see where that goes. But I our view is that it was successful in many ways. And I think you should probably look a little closer at the numbers before claiming that it sucked money out of state parties. The the political process was funded very well in this last election on both sides.
Professor Hellman.
Arthur Hellman from Pittsburgh. A question for Mr. Schiff. You mentioned in your opening remarks that in September 2006, the Judicial Conference of the United States promulgated a new set of disclosure rules. And I think those started becoming effective, or the reports started going online about January or February 2007. So we have roughly, what is it now, about a year and 6 months worth of these reports. I'd be curious, could you tell us how many judges have reported going to conferences in the last 18 months, and which organizations have been sponsoring these, how many they are, and which they are? Thanks.
There was a Legal Times article in 2007 that covered this. The numbers were it was inconclusive. There are a lot of, as I said, exceptions to the rules in terms of trips that you already went on that you don't have to report. This one group on the left, the Securities Class Action Lawyers group, was one I think that had reported, and then there were several. Several others, but I don't have that exact information. I thought you were going to ask why did we go forward with this so soon after the disclosure came out, which I think is a fair question, and so let me answer it. There were two reasons. One, because the disclosure rules had these loopholes, we were unconvinced of the effectiveness of it, and there was already concern about whether the disclosure that was required was actually happening. And secondly, we're in the middle of Congress deciding whether to raise the salaries of federal judges significantly. And we thought that it's an opportunity to address this ethical issue as part of the pay raise issue, just as honoraria bans were put in place when congressional pay was raised back in the early 90s. And sometimes in legislation you have to pick your spots, and this seemed like the right place to raise the issue. So that's why we decided to do it at that point.
I hate to keep correcting here, but it is not correct that judges only had to start reporting their reimbursements for judicial educational seminars in 2006. At least since I've been on the court since 1990, that rule has been in place since 1990, and the Code of Conduct Committee gave advice that you have to report. So I don't know what you're talking about when you say that.
I'm talking about the Judicial Conference regulations that came out in 2006, which also required the groups to disclose their...
Yeah, that was the difference. It's not that judges are suddenly have to report. Judges have been reporting this for 20 years.
And do you report the value of the trips?
It's the sponsor of the program reports their donors. That's what's changed. And as far as the value of the trip, that's... What is the value of 3 days with Donald Kagan at Yale on listening to a seminar about the history of the Peloponnesian War? How do I report the value of that?
In drachmas. That's really what I was talking about. I guess the answer would be, according to MasterCard, priceless.
Mr. Callahan?
I may have misunderstood you, but I...
You better say who you are, because...
My name is Larry Callahan, thank you, from San Francisco. I may have misunderstood you, but did you say that the ABA, in general, is not exempt from this?
I'm not entirely sure, because, again, the Judicial Conference will make that decision, but as I read, actually, the text of the bill...
Let me tell you how I read it so you can correct it. It says a general or subject matter bar association. Isn't the ABA a general bar association?
I'm sorry, this is my fault. I tried to fit this all on one slide. So I summarize. So the stuff in brackets is my paraphrase. The text is state or local bar association, so perhaps I should have made, replaced general with something like that.
Right, and my only sense was that since it specifies the judicial division of the American Bar Association, that would suggest that the American Bar Association in general is not accepted.
Reading the way it was up on the screen. Thank you.
Can I comment? There's another oddity about this. If you look at it carefully, if I go to a judicial educational seminar, I can't get reimbursed. But if somebody organizes a judicial golf tournament, I can get reimbursed. up to $2,000.
Can I ask just one thing, since we're talking about the text of this? One thing, I'm not a separation of powers guy, and I'm not sure there's any constitutional problem here, but here's one thing that somewhat puzzles me about this. So the $2,000 is adequate for much intra-U.S. travel. There are some problems when it's a high-expense destination. $400 hotel rooms may sound shocking, but probably not in New York, at least with less that check. Although, thankfully, I always get reimbursed. But, you know, probably in most situations, unless it's a longish trip, of which there are some, and unless you're traveling from Hawaii or in some situations even from California, it won't be much of a problem, but a huge, huge, huge problem for any international stuff. So if you're invited to give a talk in Rome or in Johannesburg or Tokyo or whatever else, the $2,000 will run out very, very quickly. But, of course, acceptance to any trip approved by the Department of State to promote the rule of law or developing legal systems. To promote the rule of law sounds very broad. Virtually anything can be said to promote the rule of law. But it does mean that sort of if judges do want to give talks outside of the U.S., they have to have the approval, not just of Congress on a statutory basis, but of whatever the sitting Department of State is. Now, I don't think there's much of a First Amendment issue here because I don't think there's really much of an issue when you're talking about talking to foreign audiences. But I'm curious, Mr. Schiffer, do you think there's any problem with sort of putting judges in a position where if they do think of their, of part of their mission as getting to talk to judges from other countries and spreading American legal ideas to other countries, my former boss, Justice O'Connor, was one who did have very much that view, that they would be kind of have to stay on the good side of the State Department in order to do that? Now, maybe Supreme Court justices, the State Department worries more about whether it's staying on their good side. But I could imagine some judges, especially some of the lower-profile judges, being a little bit troubled by that. Is there reason to trouble, or would it just be kind of an automatic approval by the State Department?
I'm not sure. Of course, when this was written, the State Department was in the hands of President Bush. And,
it'll go.
It could very well have gone to the other side. In the last election, so this obviously wasn't any intent to do this. I mean, the alternative is to say all foreign travel is basically out because it can't be done for under $2,000. This seemed like a reasonable way. And frankly, I think the State Department has better things to do than to try to distinguish between judges. But there's supposedly there could be some concern.
I got the cutoff sign, but I'm going to give you your last question.
Oh, thank you. I'm Allie Brown from Charleston, South Carolina, where we have beautiful golf courses and very reasonable green fees. In case you I'd like to just shift the conversation a tiny bit to judges in the media. I think lately we've seen examples of many judges who enjoy the limelight that comes with a high-profile case. And I'm wondering if maybe we should be moving towards a regulation that would prohibit or discourage judges from holding press conferences or giving interviews to members of the media regarding their personal opinions of cases.
I'm not sure I understood the question.
I would think that would raise even more of clearly a First Amendment problem. Again, maybe not an insuperable problem because you could say, well, judges are government employees, but then you have to show that there really is a pretty substantial interference with government functioning from judges doing that. And it's not clear to me that they're ordinary employees, that maybe as independent constitutional office holders, as with legislators, obviously they're a different kind of office holders, but they would, that they're entitled to convey their views. It may be unwise, and I'm sure there's a lot of, and probably a lot of very effective intra-professional pressure that, you know, if the Chief Justice calls up on the judge and says, look, I can't tell you what to do, but think about how this will look. I think that's probably the way that would be constrained. I would think there would be some pretty clear First Amendment problems with any statute that bars that kind of comment.
Can I? I'm not sure I understood your question, and this may not be responsive, but the code of conduct that governs federal judges says that no federal judge shall comment on the merits of any pending or impending case. And it doesn't matter where the case is. I would have violated that if I had commented on the O.J. Simpson case, even though it wasn't in our court. And it's been construed rather broadly, the merits of any pending or impending. Impending means any case that might come up in the future. I don't know if that answers your question.
I would like to comment on something that Mr. Schiff said with respect to the Department of State. I think that you may be disconnected from what current practice is. About 2 months ago, I tried to put together a trip of several judges from my circuit and other circuits to go to Havana, Cuba, being a former Cuban, within the regulations of the Treasury Department. We were told by the Department of State that they didn't like the idea of our going down, and they went so far as to say that if we persisted in going down to Cuba, they would take congressional action to make sure that the Pay Restoration Act would not hit the floor. So, with that little anecdote.
Let's be happy we have a new State Department coming in.
I'd like to thank each of the panelists. We've had a terrific time. Thank you very much.